We'll continue the economics discussion. And in this session, we're very fortunate to have three of the great European economists give the European perspective on the Trump economic policies and everything else that's going on. I'll introduce all three of them. We'll have some opening remarks from each one of them and then have a discussion. Closest to me is Thomas Meyer. He's the founding director of the Von Starch Research Institute in Germany. He's formerly the chief economist of Deutsche Bank Group and head of Deutsche Bank Research for Germany. Barbara Kolm is the president of the Hayek Institute, Vienna, founding director of the Austrian Economic Center and former vice president of the Austrian Central Bank. I'll say that in English for my own preservation. And then lastly is Rainer Eichenberger, who is a professor for economics and financial policy at University of Freiburg in Switzerland. And we'll start with whoever wants to begin with their opening remarks. We'll go down the line, and then I will start the questions. Who wants to go first?
Well, in that case, start. Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you, Scott, for the kind introduction, for having us here and being able to discuss what is going on literally in Europe. I mean, we are, and don't take me wrong, I am, first of all, Tyrolean, Austrian economist as well, and then, of course, European. But we have to look what is going on in Europe these days. And we face central planning, the kind of central planning that Hayek had warned us 80 years ago. And this is central planning is coming out of Brussels. It's overregulation, it's bureaucracy, it's destroying our enterprises, it's wrong policies. We have forgotten what the subsidiarity principle is about, saying, you know, you have solved the problems on the local level, then you go to the next level on the regional, then on the national, and then finally you end up at the supranational level. But that is actually not the case. Brussels is ruling towards top down and imposing regulation and laws. And just 13,000 bureaucratic acts over the past 5 years that were imposed on our enterprises. And then you are surprised why our enterprises don't grow, why we actually have negative growth rates in Europe. And those are the things that we need to talk about. But I prepared a couple of remarks. And thank you, Joshua, for bringing up not only the Taylor rule. We should also look at the natural interest rate. Because the natural interest rate in Europe is zero, by now maybe 0.5%, but it used to be more than negative. But you also mentioned stable coins, and I just quote the new incoming governor of the Austrian Central Bank 2 days ago. He said CBDCs, actually the digital euro, is an answer to US stable coins. We all know stable coins are private, are independent. You may look at the Genius Act that was started a couple of months ago by the president, but this is private, whereas CBDCs, the digital euro, is programmable, and it's ECB. So those are two definitely separate things. You must not throw them in one basket. But we Europeans do. And what will be the consequences if we use those CBDCs or if they are imposed on us? Not only that we lose cash, one thing, but right now they say we will never abandon cash. I doubt it. So be aware. Just, look at that. But it will be more or less controllable. And we have the GDPR, the Data Protection Act. We have the AI Act in Europe. And if that's not enough, then we now have CBDCs. So just an aside note. which context are we in Europe? So the European economic decline, if you look at the data, in 2008, EU GDP per capita stood at 77% of the US level. In 2023, it plunged to 50%, and 2 years later, it's even lower. US GDP in 2024 was almost 30 trillion, EU 19.4 trillion, and China 18.8 trillion. So again, the decline is literally visible. Same with the government size and the inefficiency. If Europe claims that they want to de-bureaucratize, deregulate with the so-called omnibus programs, which are the programs where they announce deregulation, nothing happens at all. I mean, we are still lagging behind. Government spending in Europe is across 49.2 of GDP compared to the US 33.9 approximately. So we overspend. We have huge welfare states that we cannot solve, that we cannot tackle. We also have our immigration issues, and above all, we have the Green Deal. And if that is not enough, we have had the EPI programs, the asset purchasing programs, starting out of the European Stability Mechanism, and then we had the Green Deal triggering inflation. Then we had COVID with the lockdowns, with the PEP programs, the pandemic emergency purchasing programs, and we have a huge amount of money in circulation. So this, in addition to this overregulation, is a bureaucrat, and the bureaucratic paralysis is literally destroying Europe. So on a positive note, what is happening was the wake-up call, thanks to J.D. Vance's speech in Munich at the Security Conference in February, when the elites of Europe were shocked, but we literally said the truth. Mm-hmm. Wake up, do your homework. And our homeworks, when it comes to structural reforms, have not been done. I personally am a big fan of unilateral free trade. As an Austrian economist, of course, I hate regulation, and I don't like those tariffs, and I don't think it's a good thing. But what we can have to see, President Trump is using them as a political bargain chip, nothing else. If Europe is too stupid to act in a different way, then it's our own fault. But we see other countries, and I would like to take the example of President Milei. In Argentina, I'm sure that he sooner or later will come up with a zero tariff unilateral trade agreement. And modern technology actually should make all those things possible. And that's what our elites, political elites, keep forgetting. On another note, tariffs actually not only violate free trade principles, but you know they are self-inflicted. We could have done differently. One more point that I would like to cover is Europe's missteps when it comes to innovation. If we look at the number of patents and compared to the U.S., Europe is way back. We are lagging behind. The money that is so-called used for innovation that is set on the side is only going to those industries that actually already have all the money available, and the new startups starve, more or less. In contrast, I just have data here from Israel and South Korea. Israel invests 6.3% of GDP in R&D, South Korea 5%, and the US 3.4, and Europe is way below that magic 2% number. Overall, and then I'm stopping here, geopolitical fragmentation and global competition. So why do we need competition? And again, Hayek, he explained competition as a discovery process. with that, with the cooperation, coordination of the markets. Markets don't fail. It's political failure that destroys and disturbs markets. So we need to come back to those classic libertarian pro-market rules where supply and demand meet and where we don't have constant interventions by politics. So this is what would help us grow again, what would help us make us competitive again, and what would bring Europe back on track. So what would be the solutions? One would be rethink Brussels, go back to the old principles of the four European freedoms, and literally look at it as a competitive free trade area, and also allow free trade with other countries, and really go into this unilateral free trade thing, and why not be the first ones and start with that? And lastly, the geopolitical challenges that Europe faces, whether it's Ukraine or whether it's down in Israel. I think we should take a step back and mind our own business right now and do our homework, structural reforms, and allow enterprises and businesses to strive. And individual freedom should be the most important thing. We will talk about free speech. This is something that needs to be done. And I'll stop here. Thank you.
Yes, from a Swiss perspective, it's of course difficult to talk about what Europe thinks about the United States, because we are living in a country with more innovation than the United States, with a higher GDP per capita than the United States. But of course you are leading with immigration, with respect to immigration. Yesterday we heard US is the most open country in the world. Great. Switzerland has the threefold of immigration than the United States when you count it compared to per capita. So you see, it's very difficult for us to have a picture of America. And even here, we do not understand what you're telling us. But when you listen to the press, of course, it's totally one-sided. Either it's pro-Trump, then you do not learn much, or it's anti-Trump, and then you do not learn much. So we have no clear picture about what is going on in the United States. And I think from European perspective, there is, of course, it's not only Trump. There is a fivefold shock in Europe. The one is Putin, of course, and Ukraine. They hadn't expected it. Despite it was clear that something will happen with this government, with this regime in Russia. The second is China, which developed differently than Europeans have expected. The third is Trump. The fourth is the Democrats in the United States, that they were not able to beat this Trump. The man who tried to make a putsch after he lost, perhaps he lost the votes. And he came back and nobody, it was a bad dream that Trump will come back. And of course he came back because the opposition or the Democrats were so bad. And that's for the Europeans who believe in, yes, so not in Trumpism, but in the Democrats. And then they see they were so bad and they even lost against this crazy Trump in some way. And the fifth shock is Europe itself. Huh? They realized this crazy Putin, crazy China, crazy Trump, and they were all better than Europe. And so Europe fall back, you have heard this. And despite the big reforms in Europe, they had these huge changes in the 90s. European market, free trade within Europe, borderless, and they had the euro, and it didn't work out. Nothing worked out. Europe had very bad 20 lost years. And so the problem in Europe is, of course, we have the best system. We have democratic capitalism, not state capitalism or party capitalism, but democratic capitalism. It's the best system. But governments exploited the system. They spent all the money. Everything is gone. Now they cannot react. Now Putin is coming, this small country, 100 million inhabitants. Europe has four times more, much more powerful economically still. And they cannot react.
because they have consumed everything, government and also the population. And so that's a problem. And now Trump is coming. He's a big disruptor. Everybody thinks, oh, that's great. And that's also here the issue. He's a disruptor. But he could also disrupt institutions. And Europeans believe in institutions. They have bad institutions, but they believe in institutions. And now what is with this disruptor? If he disrupts the American institutions, in which we are quite confident. So therefore, I think we need, the big question is, who will disrupt the disruptor? What should we do with this? That's important. And now, what is with Europe? Of course, politics is, one can say, bad, therefore the bad development. They are very protectionist. They have all these non-trade barriers, even within the European Union. What I did not understand in the discussion also today, so from my perspective, when I would be an American, I would say, oh, these Europeans, they are crazily protectionist. They have the VAT, the value-added tax. And always when you import something to Europe, you have to pay 19 to 25%. And of course, one can argue VAT is not a tariff because it's also on domestic products. But nevertheless, it's something like a tariff. And when they export goods, they can deduce the VAT. That's an export subsidy. And then, of course, you have to understand, oh, no, it's not quite this. It's compensated by the exchange rate. If the exchange rate is free, it's a very difficult discussion, but most people do not understand it. So, and I think from a normal point of view, a VAT is very close to a tariff, and therefore I'm always astonished that this is not more of an issue in the discussion. And of course, Europe has a problem because we have this even worse taxes, the income tax in the United States, plus a VAT of 20%. Then you can imagine the system doesn't work. So what to do? Of course, looking for better politics. But the problem is politics is endogenous to institutions. You cannot change politics because it's endogenous to institutions. You have to change institutions. And then when you look at what's happened in Europe, and now I'm specifically on German where I know more. Look at the German institutions, and also it's more or less the same for Europe. You have, of course, you need institutions which implement political competition. Politics is a market. It's a market for politics. Supply of politics and demand of politics, there's exchange. And so it's a market. And markets work well when there is competition. And you have five types of competition. Representative democracy, direct democracy, federalism, so competition within a country, and then competition between countries. And you have competition between institutions, elected bodies. Now go through Germany. They destroyed representative democracy with having this Brandmauer, so firewall against AfD, 25% to 27% of the population votes in favor of this party. They have been excluded from politics. Direct democracy, much less than the United States. And the government is always fighting, always against direct democracy. Federalism, it has been more or less destroyed with fiscal equalization schemes and with centralization within Germany and centralization within the European Union. And for representative democracy, the European Union is not representative democratic. It's a bureaucracy. And last, and what is with competition between elected bodies? Most of the countries in Europe are parliamentary democracies. So this means the majority in the parliament has also the government, the executive power. It's not an executive which is elected and a parliament which is elected. There is some competition between the two. They are the same. So in Europe, there is almost no political competition anymore. In Switzerland, it's luckily different, but in Europe, there is a real problem. And now there is only one competition which is remaining. This international competition, Europe compared to the United States. And this is very important for Europe. And now Trump steps in again. So the big question for Europe is whether this competition between Europe and the yardstick competition with the United States, when do we take over ideas, when we adopt ideas from the United States, depends upon whether we think the United States is relevant for Europe. And if you think Trump is crazy, he is a destroyer of America, is a disruptor, and he needs to be disrupted himself, then you do not take over ideas from the United States. But if you think it was quite sane to have this disruption, he will stop with disrupting politics and he will not disrupt the good institutions, then you can take over ideas. Therefore, it's so important that the United States is developing well, and Trump is not going totally crazy. A little bit crazy is always good, but totally crazy is not good. Thanks for the attention.
Well, it's a tough act to follow these rousing introductory speeches, but let me try to make 3 points that hopefully are orthogonal to what has been said already. I'd like to pick up the idea of Trump, the disruptor, first. I think that's good. Disruption is needed, because I think many institutions, and we talked yesterday about institution change, Scott mentioned, why do we need to change them? But you also mentioned Trump as a disruptor. I think they have become outdated. Many of them have become outdated. The post-war global geopolitical order has become outdated with the rise of China, and Trump was the first one to really focus on it. But before most other presidents have probably dodged the issue. I think Trump as a disruptor in terms of the cultural war is important. Wokeism has gotten out of hand. You needed to stop this. You needed to also counter it, and that can sometimes also lead to perhaps overshooting your target, but it's necessary. So this is good disruption, I think, and we should be grateful that the Americans have voted disruptor into this position and not a continuation of the previous administration. Also, one always has to be careful what one wishes for, but in principle, I think it's a good thing, good Trump the disruptor. Where I get a little bit more skeptical is when it comes to the disruption of globalization. I mean, there is this idea, maybe you can wind the clock back. Maybe you can bring industry back to the United States through tariffs. And I read this very, very good autobiography of J.D. Vance, and I think he made a very, very colorful point. You know, what is behind this idea that you have to reindustrialize the U.S. in order also to heal wounds that have been opened up during this process of globalization, where many jobs disappeared. And this was not just an economic issue, but a social issue. And that I learned from Vance and his great book. But when you look at it, globalization, I think, was great for the US. It was really great for the, it made the US great, at least over the last, I would say, 50 years. Since the collapse of the Bretton Woods system, globalization was great because Chimerica, as the historian Neil Ferguson once called it, this symbiosis of China and the US was actually good for the US. Because what it did is it promoted in the US financialization. Now, I know this is a term that is used in a negative context by Marxists, but financialization paved the way in the US for the technological revolution. How could you have come up with the capital to fund the new technologies that are now being deployed without financialization? You would may say I'm talking my own book because I've been an investment banker for the last 20, 30 years. But I think the financial developments that we have seen since Nixon broke up the Bretton Woods system, which also was a big disruption and opened basically the way towards that. The developments that we have seen made it possible that you could raise risk capital in the US. You could fund the initial startups like Amazon, like Facebook. In Europe, you can't, because we didn't have this process. So in this regard, when Trump wants to roll the clock back, I have to disagree. This is bad disruption. So there's good disruption, there's bad disruption. Let me come to the tariffs. I mean, like many other economists, at least of my age, I've been, you know, raised with Adam Smith and David Ricardo, and you recoil from tariffs. You say, oh my God, this can't be true. I mean, there are very few paradigms in economics that really stick, but, you know, gains from trade is one that sticks. Then I had second thoughts, and I was then reading up on Albert Hirschman. I don't know whether anyone in the room knows him. Albert Hirschman wrote in 1945 a book entitled National Power and the Structure of Foreign Trade. And he was the first one that at least I know who saw that it's not only about free trade and gains from trade in the Adam Smith, David Ricardo world. Trade is also politics in the real world. And Hirschman came up with an interesting theory of trade and politics. And when you look at Hirschman, you can at least understand some of the elements that Trumponomics is about. I would say Trumponomics is a bit too chaotic for Hirschman. He wouldn't like it because he would like to have a more structured approach to it. But you can see elements in it. One element is you use trade if you are a dominant trading partner. You use trade as a power instrument. Yeah. And the US is a dominating trading partner. When I was sort of running around in the investment banks, we were always talking about the US consumer as the consumer of last resort. This is enormous monopsony power that the US has. So from the Hirschman concept, Trump is using this monopsony power to break up things that are bad for the US, like the free rider position of the Europeans as far as NATO is concerned. Other things that the protectionism in Europe, we are often quite, wrong to say that Europe is the beacon of free trade. No way. We are protectionists. We were more protectionists than the US before Trump. Now I'm not so sure we have to do the calculations, but we are more protectionists than Trump before. And he uses trade in a Hirschman style to break this up. Now I think from Hirschman there follows also some advice what you do if you are at the receiving end. The answer by Hirschman is basically trade diversification. And this is, I think, what the European approach now should be. We are not in a strong position. So I would agree with what Barbara said, that we should respond to the Trump challenge with zero tariffs. It's good unilaterally. Why should our consumers not get US cars and other stuff without any tariffs? It's good for us. And we can perhaps fend off worse things coming from the US. But we should also apply Hirschman and say trade diversification is the key to reduce the dependence on this monopsony. This is in the making, so I'm not a big fan of Ursula von der Leyen, but I think at this point in time, she's going in the right direction, not fighting Trump, and at the same time, trying to strike other trade deals, Mercosur and other things. That would be, I think, the right response from that perspective. And of course, we should be a bit more self-critical. As I say, we have been hypocrites as far as the beacon of free trade is concerned. We should go the way that Barbara suggested. My third point was already mentioned, I think by Barbara, but also Rainer. This is Europe itself. And you know, sometimes I have become, having been always sort of a financial guy and a modeling guy, I've become a hobby historian because I think history is able to teach an economist maybe more than just mathematical models, because mm-hmm. I have been doing so much econometrics and made so many wrong forecasts with it. So I'm going back to history and read it up.
You should have looked more at Austrian economics.
Yeah, well, I'm a big fan of Hayek, by the way. Reading this history, especially what I fell in love with is the history of the Roman Empire and the decline of the Roman Empire. And listening to Barbara, you know, it kind of feels a bit like the stories that the historians tell about how a Roman citizen must have felt around 400, 500 after Christ. They lived still relatively well, you know. The challenges were there. They didn't really live up to the challenges. The big disruption came in the form of immigration by Germanic tribes. The Roman Empire fell in 476. A German tribe leader was taking over Rome. And they sent the Roman emperor into retirement. They didn't behead it. Not bad. Retirement. Big, big disruption. The Roman Empire was gone. There's also coming creation out of destruction. But it took 1,000 years before we saw the creation after the destruction. 1500 with the Renaissance, we connected back. So I would like us to be a bit faster. This, you know, raises the big question, is Europe reformable in our lifespan? Or do we have to wait another 1,000 years? And here I see quite a few problems. They were already mentioned by the previous speakers. But the biggest problem that I see underlying the European mentality is the reliance on the state. This is something deeply ingrained, deeply embedded, I would say. And it doesn't come out of the blue. We had a sequence of crises since the financial crisis, which I consider to be a hiatus. The downfall of the masters of the universe, that was a big hiatus. And what did the masters of the universe do? I was not a master, but a little servant in this system. When I was at Deutsche Bank in London and saw the whole house of cards coming down, what did we do? We called for the state. Please rescue us. Shortly thereafter, the euro crisis, the euro was on the verge of breaking down. What did we do? We called for the state. Please save the euro. We had Deutsche Bank at the time. We had a lot of exposure to Greece. Help us, bail us out. And then came the pandemic. What did we do? We had lockdowns and we called for the state. Please help us. Send us the checks. We can't work, we're sitting up, but we want to have the checks. And then comes the perma crisis, you could say, perhaps. At least the media have made it to the perma crisis, climate change. This is the choker for the state. It beats every other card. You know, mankind is extinguished by global warming. What do you need? The super state. You need to regulate our lives so that mankind survives. Sum it all up, and you see why the Europeans have become addicted to the state to solve all their problems. It's deeply ingrained. And you have to fight this mentality before you can get anywhere. And I'm not sure whether we have the time to do this in our lifespan. My last point, I was looking recently at the structure of the German electorate. And I found out there's a study by Deutsches Institut der Wirtschaft, so this is the IW Institute, it's an employer related, that about half of the German households, half, are net recipients of government money. And this study is from 2019. Meanwhile, a lot of the baby boomers have gone into retirement. Add on all the state employees that have mushroomed under the traffic light coalition. And I would extrapolate this study and say more than half of the electorate in Germany are net recipients of government money. Would they vote the government out of business? Thank you.
Okay, thanks for those remarks. I'm going to start off the questions. There's so many things to ask. I'd like to pick up on the idea of energy and the energy transition and really the economic impact, particularly what's going on with the sort of reversal mode of Trump, talking about disruption, where he's this, the phrase drill baby drill to get back to fossil fuel usage, because I don't think you have to be an economist to realize that low-cost energy is critical to development, particularly in the developing world. Where we're trying to, the developed world often tries to start limiting the energy, the fossil fuel energy dependence of the developing world as if they can afford to rely on wind power. And I sort of wanted to hear the thoughts on the reaction to how successful even Trump will be and the new administration will be on stopping what many people is an irrational value of wind and solar and all this, vis-a-vis the reality of the needs of energy. Also, adding to the energy equation is, I think it was Merkel, if I'm not mistaken, who'd started to depend so much on Russia for energy, for fundamental needs, when it's a clear adversary. I'm not sure that was a very wise decision, but what's the impact nowadays going on? And then the third point about energy is the new energy requirements of the whole AI world and how this is coming into practice. Who wants to tackle any of that?
It's not true that low-cost energy is important. Real cost energy is important, so that energy is paying the real cost. And so this means we need to have a polluter pay principle, but we do not know what really the damages of the pollutions are, neither with respect to nuclear energy, with respect to wind energy. It's crazy. All these windmills, it's destructive for everything. And it's also with fossil fuels, there is, of course, is pollution and there is a problem. So we need the polluter pay principle. But, so of course, everybody says this, but the important thing what we have to add as economists is we need to have the polluter pay principle, but all the money which the polluters are paying has to go back to the population by reducing income tax and VAT. That's the important thing. And then if you have this rule, this very simple rule, there may be as much polluter pay taxes, but the money has to go back to the population by reducing taxes. Then we have an intelligent discussion, because then discussing about the polluter pay principle and how high that these taxes should be, environmental taxes, it's not a biased discussion, because nobody has interests to take the money. But what today is happening, all these European programs with all these CO2 certificates which you have to buy in order to be allowed to pollute in some way, all the money or most of the money is taken by government. And they spend it for their cronies and they spend it for themselves. That's the problem. And as soon as we have here, we need to have the good institutions, the money back guarantee, and of course, not anymore as much regulation, because if we have the right price for fuels and the right polluter pay premium, we do not need all the regulations anymore, and we do not need subsidies for everything, because the price is right. And that is the way to go, where not cheap energy, but the adequate price for energy.
Maybe I can add something from the German situation, which I think is one of the most dire one in Europe, because Germany is really in part still is a very industrial economy. When you look at the structure of employment, I mean, most other European countries have more people in the service sector. And the energy policy of the Merkel government and the following government has basically brought German industry on the verge of destruction. It was a completely misguided policy, you alluded to it. Merkel retracted the expansion of the lifetime of nuclear power plants on the basis of a tsunami in Japan, which caused a lot of deaths, but not from radiation, no proven death from radiation. But we, the only country in the world, moved on a fast track out of nuclear. moving on a fast track out of nuclear, moving on a fast track out of coal. And we had a coal commission which was populated, staffed by all sorts of people, including theologists, environmentalists, but very few economists, and pulling an industrial economy, depriving an industrial economy simultaneously of coal power, nuclear power, and relying only on unreliable renewables is a disaster. And we're finding this out. They're leaving. Germany is going downhill, and Merkel's gamble of replacing nuclear and coal with cheap Russian gas disastrously backfired. So I think we are in the doldrums right now, thanks to this energy policy that we've had. This doesn't say that I'm not an all-out enemy of renewables. No, they're great. I mean, the sun is spending us energy for free. The wind, if used with measure, is providing us also sources of energy. So we should have an energy creation portfolio with nuclear, ideally new nuclear techniques, with gas. We import LNG from the US, because in Germany, when I say we, but we could do it ourselves. There is gas in the ground, but the Germans are so panic-stricken to start fracking that they rather pay off and have LNG come from the US, and the US are not so panic-stricken about fracking. So this is all crazy, this whole thing. Energy policy is really a disastrous legacy that we have from the Merkel government, which is not being corrected up to this point.
And of course, when you pull back from nuclear, because it takes so many years or such a delay, it's really a longer term disaster than just that can be fixed. It can't be fixed so quickly. Yeah. I
mean, it's a joke of the century. The German industry has to import nuclear power energy from France at three times the price that they would have produced. So, and then you wonder why the German industry is strangulated.
And we're paying Austria for exporting surplus renewable energy so that they can use it and pump the water up the mountains.
Yeah. What the industry needs is reliable, constant energy. Yeah. And we've seen in Spain, when Spain announced, well, finally we have green energy available, 3 days later, the grid broke down. And this is the things that we need to look at. And this is the last sentence about that, which means, in other words, recalibrate the state and constantly ask the question, what is the task of government? All European governments have failed in investing into the grids. Our grids in Europe, our electrical grids, are 50 years old, more or less. And we cannot deliver energy to our industries in the way they need it. So this is our problem.
Okay, questions?
Thank you. Thank you for being with us today. My name is Peter Lee Hamilton. I'll preface this by saying I'm not an economist. It was very kind of Reiner earlier today to ask me if I was. I had to apologize and tell him that I'm a lawyer. We'll have to deal with that on our own time. But so we've talked about so much today, right? And we've talked about energy policy, tariffs, welfare states, inflation, interest rates. We've alluded to immigration and Ukraine. And it just shows that economics and economic policy touches everything. And economics is both factual in the sense that there is an optimal economic policy to implement. And I think most people here would likely err on the side of free market policies. But it is also political in that economics is ultimately implemented through the state. And so to that end, there seems to be a disconnect in that the majority of people feel that the state and society is failing them. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal earlier this week that said Americans no longer believe that hard work will result in economic advancement. Joshua was talking about how people voted for Trump, whether they knew it or not, based on economics, and whether they took a NatCom perspective or a free marketeer perspective, they ultimately believed that Trump would implement economic policies that would allow them to succeed. Sometimes those things are aligned, right? Trade imbalances are not theoretically negative if the trade imbalances result from, you know, sound competition. If the trade imbalance is a result of one country implementing one-sided tariffs, then a trade imbalance is obviously a bad thing. But this is all to the point of saying, in order to be able to effectively respond to these problems, decision makers need to believe and support free market policies. And the question I have is, how do we convince decision makers that they should prioritize those things? One thing you can try to do is to convince the populace that free market policies are good. Reiner, you spoke about the need to retake institutions and how Germany is an institution-driven place. In business school, one of my classmates was an exchange student from Germany, and he talked about how he loved America so much and he wanted to move to America, not just because he loved the NFL and football, but real football, but because he, in Germany, he felt that they did not look on entrepreneurs as a noble profession and that you had to hide success and you had to hide wealth, and that was one of the cultural issues within Europe. And so I guess my question is, and this can be applied to the United States as well, is how do we begin retaking institutions to promote free market policies? Is that something where we need to focus on decision makers? Is that where we need to focus on the general populace? Who do we target and how do we target them?
Go ahead.
By running conferences like that, educating the next generation, bringing them into this field of ideas and making sure they understand why property rights matter, why capitalism matters, and why we need independent thinkers. I think this is these are the basic principles and why we also need to constantly ask our politicians, and I'm a politician myself now as well, put price tags on everything you provide so people understand finally what their tax money goes in for or what they pay with their tax money. I think those are the most important things.
I'm a bit of a cynical
guy. And Hayek, sorry, may I add this? Hayek said, we can only change society top-down right now with modern technology, AI in progress, all this information tools. We can also do it bottom-up. So we now are in the position to change from both sides, and eventually people will understand.
If I may give you the more cynical answer to what Barbara said. Sorry, as a finance guy, I'm kind of prone to a bit of cynicism. I think the public will only follow a pathological learning curve, i.e. you only learn from dead bodies. So you first have to have the crisis and then it's getting better. The problem is that, you know, the state you were referring to has two functions. One is supply of public goods, internal, external security, infrastructure, and so on. And to do this, you can have a relatively small state, like in the Gilded Age in the US, end of the 19th century, that allowed great entrepreneurial developments. And the second function of the state that has been ever increasing is the redistribution and insurance. Right? What we are now seeing is, you say that people feel the state is failing them. It is the overtaxing of the ability of the state to deliver on both counts. And I think we have to go through this process. And I think Josh alluded to this in his opening remarks. In the end, the conflict of what people demand from the state and what the state can deliver will result in more debt. We already see this. The next step, we already have taken the entry into this, is the monetization of the debt. The next step is inflation. What follows from this is more political disruption and hopefully out of the destruction, some creation. But I'm not so optimistic as Barbara that we can educate the people by reasoning with them.
Of course, it's very difficult, as I said, out of more or less five big types of institutions on this which bring competitiveness in markets. Direct democracy, representative democracy, federalism, international competition, and these checks and balances or competition among elected bodies. And they protect each other and support each other, and then if only there is one, it will be destroyed. There is always centralization, cartels among governments, and so it's a problem. So what can we do? And I can only tell you the Swiss perspective. The first is we should
keep far away from the European Union. Then at least there is competition between Switzerland and the rest in Europe. That's very important. You should subsidize us that we stay far apart from the European Union. The second is we need a new institution. And this is, I try to think about proposals which do not need politics without politicians. And so I would like to have your support. We need money. Because in Switzerland we have direct democracy, we can make initiatives at the national level. And of course nobody makes good initiatives because it's a public good. They all are in favor of some specific interests. So we need initiatives which care for the public good, which bring in really good political proposals, which are good for everyone. And good for everyone is what? Free markets. And how can you make an initiative with free markets? It's very simple. There should be a prize, Grand Prix, for an initiative which wins the support of the population. They should be paid. And this is very simple. All initiatives which are adopted by the population are good initiatives because obviously they bring an advantage to the majority of the population. And so we only need this prize. It's very cheap in Switzerland. We have had in Swiss history, we have had 25 initiatives which were adopted. So when you pay 2 million per initiative, it costs you in the last 100 years 50 million. It's nothing compared with when we think about Elon, what Elon gets as a bonus. So try to get from Elon 1 billion or not. And we make a fund and we pay for all initiatives in Switzerland which make the majority of the population, we pay 2 million. It will change Switzerland tremendously and it will change the world. Because this will be, I think, Millet could make the same. And Switzerland will be so tremendously successful with this that it will spread around the world.
But why does a rich country like Switzerland need a foreign sponsor?
Because in Switzerland, so I tried to find sponsors. And they always say, oh no, we should only subsidize real free market initiatives. And they said, no, it's very difficult to discern what is free market and what is not. So we should subsidize all initiatives which are good. And the best measure for what is good is the population in favor of it and the majority of the cantons. Huh? This is quite difficult.
It sort of reminds me of the phrase that it's very easy to spend other people's money. to me, the fundamental problem that first step level thinking is there's no accountability to where the spending is. There's no transparency. But what I mean by accountability is simply the transparency of what is being spent on what. And this was where Elon Musk and the so-called Doge effort came in first to expose what was being done, because no one, I actually believe no one in government even knows what the money's going to. So I think there's several steps before you get to, you know, what the government should do. What is being done? And I think this fundamental problem, a lack of responsiveness or even the lack of demand by individual voters to finding out what is being done with their money is a necessary first step.
And then you make 2 million.
Put a price tag on it.
Put a price tag. Okay, next question. We'll take one more question.
It is in Alejandro Buxeda from Schweizer Monat. It is indeed very easy to spend other people's money. There was a famous phrase by Javier Milei. I don't know if he coined it, but it was in Spanish. Con el culo ajeno todos somos putos, which means that we would be willing to sell our, we would be willing to give sexual services if we were using someone else's ass. And that's absolutely true. Maybe it's coined in a very impolite way, but it hints in at the core of what the question I wanted to ask you guys, which is that I see this world is one in which not everyone realizes the valuing of our currency simultaneously. And if you are a debtor, as Joshua was previously mentioning, you benefit from the creditors. There's the biggest redistribution of wealth that ever has existed happens in the fiat ecosystem, in which if you owe money all to other people, you basically get redistributed towards you. And so I don't know the degree to which Thomas would be in agreement with this line of thought, but I think that most of the financial system is basically that, trying to get closer to the money spigot and realizing the devaluing of the currency sooner than others to be able to profit from that arbitrage. And I'm very, I have to disclose my bias, I'm very in line with Barbara here in the Austrian school perspective. And I think most of the rhetoric going around how devaluing our currency increases the competitiveness of our economy in terms of export is just Keynesian statism apologia. If you devalue your currency, but the locals haven't realized it fully enough yet, what you're basically making is selling your products for less than it takes to maintain your infrastructure. So you're underselling your services and your stocks and everything. And the reverse is also true. If you have deflation, you would increase the competitiveness in the long term because you're overselling, you're increasing the bar for a business to be profitable, mm-hmm. apparently. But in the long term, it's the best thing that can happen. So yes. I wanted to hear from Thomas this view, to which degree the financial system is just trying to benefit from the creditors and the debtors taking advantage of it, and from Barbara, the perspective on how the degree to which it is true that inflation is actually detrimental to competitiveness and deflation would be actually beneficial. And then if you could guys manage this, the Bitcoin and Joshua mentioned of it previously was very, it made me very happy because I'm starting to see this Austrian economics applied to a protocol, and in this case money is Bitcoin, and it's incredibly promising.
I'm a slow learner, so I was very much already in my job when I started to think about the money system, and it was basically because we hit the wall when I was at Deutsche Bank and the financial crisis came, and we were dumbfounded, what is going on there? And I went back and looked a bit at the monetary system, and I come to the conclusion that the fiat money system, which by the way, is not so old, it came into being with the breakup of the Bretton Woods system by Richard Nixon, first the delinking of the linkage of the dollar to gold in 71, and then subsequently we had the end of the exchange rate system and we had the floating rate system. The fiat money system is a blessing and a curse in a sense. The blessing I already alluded a bit to, with the breakdown of the Bretton Woods system, we got capital liberalization. Previously, capital accounts were very much restricted. We got capital account liberalization. We got financialization, and I think that was, in principle, a good thing because it allowed financial developments. The bad thing of the fiat money system is that it creates inherent instability. Being a Hayekian, Barbara will immediately know what I mean. I'm not a Hayekian institutionalist, but I'm a disciple of Hayek. And I think the fiat money system is creating a lot of boom-bust cycles, as you can create money out of nothing, through lending and fund investment that then leads to an artificial boom, rents rise, and then you got the bust thereafter. Combine this with an inflation targeting central bank, which is faced by an inflation that is depressed by technical innovation and globalization, and you get a serial bubble construction. Now, they always sort of keep the interest rates below the natural one, which creates a bubble, then they bail out the next bubble because they reduce rates even more, the next bubble comes. And by the way, I think that now with AI, which I'm very favorable to, I think it's a big game changer. It will raise productivity. Combine AI, which raises the natural rate, as I think it raises productivity, with an inflation targeting central bank, because when you raise productivity, you also depress inflation, and you get another serial bubble blowing instrument. So I'm bracing myself, an investor, now for even more bubbles to come as the central banks will react in a inappropriate way to the productivity gains that we see to inflation. So it's an inherently flawed system, number one. It is an inherently regressive distributional system because the big beneficiaries are the people close to the money creation process, right? I mean, I think description of a poor banker is an oxymoron. There is no poor banker. The bankers are always close to the money creation process and get the spoils of it. Same applies to the central bank. When I was still more active in the investment banking business and I was going to conferences, and the most lavish conferences are laid out by central banks because they can print their money to pay for the expenses. Correct me if I'm wrong, Barbara.
No, you're right.
So the central banks are big fans of the fiat credit system. And when there was the Swiss initiative, this is great about Switzerland, that you have the ability to actually ask the people. I was very close to the guys who were doing this initiative for 100% money, doing away with the money creation ability of the commercial banks. And as I talked to them, said they were making great progress. People felt that this was a good idea not to have the money creation process vested to the banks. We do it ourselves. Well, okay, they wanted to have the Swiss National Bank do it, but you could talk about it. And then the SNB came out against it, said this is dangerous, it will do a lot of harm, and everyone backtracked. They saw how the approval ratings and went down. And of course, the central banks, the commercial banks have no interest in reforming the system. And this is where I see now the cryptos bringing an enormous transformation power onto the scene. First they fought it. Remember Jamie Dimon? Crypto is bad. Crypto is devil stuff. And it's now gone. Josh was saying his colleagues tell him crypto is bad. Well, the colleagues, the academics, they love to go to central bank conferences. So they have to say crypto is bad because that's what the central banks want to hear. But crypto is a real challenge to the fiat money system. Hayek now talked about the denationalization of money. And for a long time, people thought Hayek is a crazy guy, talk about denationalization of money, privatization. But now, for the first time, it's for real. You can do it. Bitcoin is a success. Some people say it's a crazy speculation. No, it's a success. Look at the price of Bitcoin. And I think we'll see more. Now we have the stable coins with Genius Act, which actually was quite a genius, because what they did in the Genius Act, sorry if I'm too long,
but no, go ahead.
What they did in the Genius Act, they built a bridge for the conservative guy like myself and my asset management outfit I'm working for. We can go over this bridge. Before that, oh my God, this unregulated stuff, fraud, everything. But with Genius Act, you have now a bridge, a regulated market, and the conservative investor can get into it, which he couldn't before. Second, they allow financial institutions without banking license, so fintechs, to issue coins. Very important. We had already a year earlier, we had in Europe already a regulation for stable coins, but that was tied to a banking license, and the banks killed it. So you see hardly a euro stablecoin. Tether tried it. It has a small circulation, couple hundred million, but nothing really. So Genius Act is important as a bridge to get into. And now you will see more. There's talk about a gold coin. Now there is Tether is in talks with some of the gold mining associations to buy gold mines. Sooner or later, I think you will see a gold-backed coin. So we move from the stable coins backed by treasuries, the stable coins backed by something else. Eventually, we'll end up probably with the Hayek scheme.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I think we're going to have to call it out of the time issues. But thank you very much. And people can ask questions. We'll take a 10-minute break. Thank you.